Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on NABBAclub.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker tonight. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, Duke D comes from Triangle. I've seen Duke in the Saturday 9 a.m. men's meeting at Triangle more than one occasion. And Tim had expressed that we should have him come to speak to us. And he brought a crowd with him. Good support. Thanks a lot, Duke.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for coming out. Thanks for coming out on a Halloween night. I know, looking up here, this guy at the podium might not be too scary, but 20 years ago on a quart of Soli, I could be your worst nightmare. I guarantee it. Well, first thing, I'm Duke. I'm an alcoholic. It's an honor to be here tonight for all of you, and of course, I readily accepted when Tim extended the invitation. I was mindful that it was 28 years ago, the summer of '83, that I came through those doors over there, kicking and screaming. I was in a meltdown with another meltdown with one of my marriages, multiple marriages. I thought I needed psychiatric help to get through it. My shrink said that he wouldn't see me unless I came to a Wednesday night meeting here at NABBA because I admitted that I was drinking too much. You know, I was one of those many alcoholics that paid $175 an hour, I guess, to lie to his psychiatrist. But anyway, I came into the room way back then, and mad as hell, didn't want to have anything to do with any of this. And if people just understood why I was having so many issues, they'd understand why I was drinking a little bit more than the normal person. So I fought through that summer, and finally, by the fall of that year, I was convinced that I had enough of an issue that I needed to check myself into an institution. So I volunteered to go over to Ridgeview for 30 days. So I want to claim my position up here at the podium. My alcoholism, like many of us here in the room, has convinced me that this is the most expensive club in America, if not the world. My alcoholism has taken me through five marriages, about the same number of DUIs, bankruptcy, all sorts of traffic accidents, broken bones, and everything else. And untold fortunes have been lost in business. I paid dearly to finally come out the other side to be basically a pretty happy guy. For the most part, I've been able to reorder all my thinking, and the first 10 or 12 years of this program, starting in '83 until 1995, when I finally was brought to my knees, and as some of my regular cohorts have heard me say before, by the summer of '95, I didn't surrender. My position was simply overrun. I didn't have the dignity of surrendering. I was completely overwhelmed with an uncanny sense of loneliness, an abiding sense of loss, and nowhere to go. My drinking had gotten to the point where I had to drink. It wasn't a question of making a decision to drink or not to drink. I absolutely had to drink. So to dial back and give you a little history about how I got there, I'll just briefly tell you that I grew up as a young, as the eldest of three sons in an Army family. I traveled all over the world with my dad's Army career as a young boy. Went to about almost a dozen schools in three foreign countries before I got to the eighth grade. I spoke two foreign languages passably. Fluent German, pretty good Spanish, and but I was mostly focused on, as a youngster, in helping my mother raise two little boys and my two younger brothers. My dad stayed away from us as much as he could. We finally divorced him once when I was 8 and then again when I was 12. And I was quite happy with that. I enjoyed being the leader of the pack and my mother's best buddy and best friend and protector. We sought refuge finally when I was 12 or 13 with her dad in Chattanooga, and I was lucky enough through a family connection to get a scholarship to a military prep school, a boarding school, so I could get away from home and start building my own world in that military environment, which I really enjoyed. And blitzed through 5 years of prep school. Grades were a snap. Academics always came pretty easily for me. I wanted to go to West Point at the time, and so that led credence to my going to a military school. And at the last minute, I opted out of West Point and ended up having to go to the University of Georgia because it was going to be on, I was going to have to pay for it myself. And so as an in-state student from the Georgia side of Lookout Mountain, University of Georgia made sense. And I worked all the way through school, had more success. I had just as much success in business in Athens as a young student as I did as a college student. I made good grades and I made good money with a couple of different money-making enterprises, thinking I was going on to law school, and I was accepted at Emory. But while registering at Emory in the summer of 66, the Vietnam War was such that they needed me for that. So I refer to that as my Robert S. McNamara Rifle Marksmanship Scholarship to Southeast Asia. And so all during that youth, and I was about 23 years old at the time, I never had any real experience with alcohol except just occasional recreational use. I never had, if it were around at a party or something, I would drink because I never had enough money to buy any beer or whiskey. So other people had to provide it in order for me to have it. So it just wasn't anything that was in my normal day-to-day routine. And of course, once I got into the Army, the training was such the first year that we never had any time for foolishness like drinking. I mean, I might have a few beers, but it was just so rare that we were all so fast-tracked to, get trained and, in my case, become an officer and then get ready to go to Vietnam. So finally, as a young second lieutenant, with a year before going to Vietnam, I got a little taste of the officer's club, and that liquor went down pretty smoothly, and I enjoyed it. But I didn't overdrink or get out of control. I was married. I married my college sweetheart as soon as I was commissioned, and so a year later went off to Vietnam, and for the best ride of my life. That 1 year was really the high point of my life, and everything since then has been downhill. And I have to tell you that when you're leading 40 or so young men day to day in battle, it's like the Super Bowl every day. The adrenaline rush that I felt, the incredible sense of of the closer we are, it said, the closer we get to death, the more full of life we become. And I was like that almost every single day. And not close to my own death, but necessarily, I never really thought about that. But we were in harm's way out there in a recon jungle environment, almost on a daily basis, facing the threat and facing many fights. And very lucky to come away from them reasonably unscathed. We all got wounded, some here and there, but I had very few people killed, and it was one of the most enormously satisfying periods of my life. And so in coming home from that, and folding up all my Army stuff and putting it away and going into as we call it over there, coming back into the world, and I went into the real estate business here in Atlanta. Ever since then, things just never seemed to have quite the edge. There was just never enough of a thrill. And I found myself seeking, you know, a little higher thrill edge, a little more adrenaline rush. I had, in my own mind, and of course I've had many years to formulate this, to look back, I think subconsciously I felt, you know, I'd helped a mother and two little brothers grow up. I'd performed well in school. I put myself through college. I put myself through 3 years in the Army, a year in Vietnam. I'd helped a lot of young guys come home. And now is my time to kind of let my hair down and go for it. And start really having it's so silly now to think about it, but to have the childhood I never felt I had. I mean, I wanted to be two people. I wanted to be a grown man pursuing a business career, but also, for the first time in my life, I was unfettered by other people's expectations and dependence. Nobody, I was just out there on my own. And so I could do whatever I damn well pleased. I'd earned the right to do whatever I pleased. So I worked hard and I partied hard. And what became hard partying in the early 70s, in my late 20s, early 30s, took about 8 or 10 years to cross that line to the point where I started thinking and being aware that I was drinking more than my peers. And I started having thoughts about it. I was 40 years old. I was on my third marriage, and wondering occasionally to myself if this drinking, these incredible hangovers that I was having, and I'm still getting up at 5:30 every morning, still showing up at the YMCA downtown on Lucky Street at 6 to play racquetball every single day of the year, rain or shine. Just feeling like somebody driven a damn ice pick through my brain half the time, but I would never wimp out on that. And I thought, if I can do that, then I must be still okay. And I just had a little bit too much to drink last night. And I kept telling myself that lie over and over and over and over again. But anyway, it crashed down on me, and I thought, well, I need to look at this. So I came into AA in 83. And sat on the edge. I sat on the fringe, and I didn't get too many fringe benefits. I stayed pretty much sober, mostly sober. I would stay dry for, I wouldn't stay sober, I'd stay dry. I stayed dry for months, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. I could never make a year, could never do it. I stopped drinking for all practical purposes in my business environment in that summer in 83. So all through the 80s and the early 90s, no one in my social world ever saw Duke Doubleday take another drink. And they noticed a change in my behavior. I was changing slightly. But I would have these meltdowns, usually brought on by depression. And I would have a temporary holiday. I kept falling back on that quotation we have in How It Works about some people are just constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And I just kind of shrugged at that line. It gave me an out. I thought, well, maybe that's it. And I had such envy and such incredible longing as I would look up and see my friends who came into the program with me in the early 80s picking up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 and beyond chips. And I'm still sitting there and I haven't gotten a single blue one. And I just go, well, fuck, I just can't get it. And maybe, you know, I could acknowledge my alcoholism, but I couldn't accept it. I couldn't accept the responsibility. I was such a jerk, such an immature jerk, that I thought, well, you know, I haven't really hurt anybody except myself. And maybe I can just keep limping along, and this will be okay. But each of those years, the impact of the alcohol and the behavior, the clouded judgment, the impact got worse and worse and worse. And another marriage or so, and I ended up having a child with my Romanian terrorist ex-wife. And that's really when the world came to an end for me. And I won't go into all the details, but obviously it was quite a dramatic period in the early 90s. And with a young son, a Romanian wife, a Romanian mother-in-law that I ill-advisedly moved here from Bucharest, I quit even having any pretense of trying to stay sober. It would just work, drink, try to cope with this international warfare at home. And pretty soon it was just like that old Chinese expression about alcoholism. Man takes a drink, the drink takes a drink, the drink takes the man. I found myself at a point in early 95, and this is after two treatment centers over a six-year period, one in 83 and another in 94. What's that, 9 years? I got my bachelor's in alcoholism at Ridgeview and I'm a master's at Sierra Tucson in Arizona. All it did was teach me a little bit more about how stupid I was. I always knew what to do. I lacked the will. I lacked the maturity to do something about it until finally, in the summer of 95, after losing my best friend, my mother, to a death of cancer, and subsequent, just within a month or so of that, a terrible loss of my son's mother and all the Romanians, snatching him away from me, and to lose him, and I haven't seen him since. It just all cratered down on me, and I tried two real half-ass. That's when I reached that point. I was ready to end my life, and that's when I reached that period that I referred to earlier as just, you know, utter loneliness and an abiding sense of loss and nothing at all to look forward to. So I decided to drown myself in my cousin's pool, only to be discovered a little while later, when they came back early, they dragged me out and pumped me out, and I was, of course, in a total blackout and don't remember much of it at all, or didn't for a long time. And once I recovered from that, 8 or 10 hours later, I decided I was really pissed off. But I was still so drunk, I wanted to write my son a note before I blew my brains out. And I went and got my pistol and I loaded it and I cocked it and I got it all ready to go. I thought, well, I just want to write him a little note to let him know how sorry I am that I couldn't stick around. The pain is just too deep. But I couldn't couldn't hold my hand steady enough to write. I said, oh, shit. If I just, maybe I'll go back to sleep for another couple of hours and then I'll do it. So that was September of 1995. And I wouldn't acknowledge it at the time, folks, but I was not jobless as a commercial real estate broker. You know, I can't ever be fired because I fire myself. I still had a profession. That's one thing I've never wandered from my profession, as bleak as it gets sometimes. But I was completely without prospect of any financial gainful activity. I was essentially homeless. Kind of looking after my mother's home in Chattanooga, sharing an apartment with a friend at his grace here in Atlanta, trying to get mother's home ready to be disposed of. And I just had nowhere to go. And these two suicide attempts didn't work. So a good friend of mine came and got me and brought me back to Atlanta. And I went that first Saturday up to the Saturday morning men's meeting at Triangle, and I said, I've had enough. This is it. And I picked out six or eight guys silently that I deeply admired and respected. And I told myself, I am such a worthless piece of shit that I'll sell myself down the river in a minute. But I think so much of these guys that if I can't do it for me, I'll do it. I've got to hold myself accountable to somebody. And until I can get a relationship with my God, with my higher power, that I had a very good relationship with 30 some odd years before in Vietnam, he saved my ass every day. But as those years went on, in the ensuing years, I lost that same connection because the threat wasn't there as much. Well, now it was back with a vengeance. So I said, until I can get a little traction, I'm just gonna go completely flat and go back into the basic training mode and do what I see these guys do, and do what I hear them suggest that I do, and take their suggestions like law, no matter what. I didn't know where this was going to go, but I didn't want to live in one respect. I'd given up on living, but I couldn't die. And alcoholism, to continue to live as a drunk is just—it was just more than I could bear. And I said, "There's no more good news than a drink for me. There's no relief in it. There was not a single moment after that terrible weekend that I ever had any imagination about, boy, it'd be sure nice to have a few beers with the guys." Yeah, I was all over that. What I wasn't over yet was the incredible sense of failure and loss, and the inclination to continue to hurt myself. You know, I'm down, and I'm so down, I'm going to really get myself down. What? That is real insanity. So I just had to splay myself open and be at the mercy of these other guys, these men, that I wanted a piece of what they had. I didn't know if I could ever get what they had, but I always wanted a piece of it and just kind of fold in the groove and be a... and just go along with the flow of the stream for the first time in my life, and not have to be special and not have to stand out. Just go along with the flow and see if I can stand it. And in being able to resign to that and to be really obedient, and almost like a private has to be in the Army, because you can only get in so much trouble if you don't. It's just not worth it. And that's why I had to become a private. I had to go into basic training mode again to finally get enough traction to see that I could build up some equity in myself, and I could restore some sense of honesty and commitment to others. It was almost an overwhelming sense of peace that came over me once I came to the conclusion that I didn't have to fight anymore, that it was okay to surrender. That term just was not in my normal vocabulary. But I happen, as a real student of history, I happen to remember in reading all about the Civil War how at one point at Appomattox, Robert E. Lee was surrounded with all the remaining soldiers that he had, and they were all saying, "Sir, we can put up one last fight. One more, we can go down swinging. We'll fight to the last man. This is our chance to really make a point." And he said, "Fellows, let's give it up. We fought the good fight. We've honored ourselves with a good fight. Our families and our homes need what's left of us to go back and rebuild. We've got to put it down. We've got to surrender and lay down our arms and go home and start again." And I thought how much strength that took for this venerated leader. They treated him like God. For him to say that and to mean it and to get his men to believe it, for them to surrender and humbly throw down their weapons and walk home to start all over again, took an enormous amount of courage. And I thought, well, that, in that sense, surrender is not weakness. It's an enormous sign of strength that you can accept that incredibly devastating humility to just try to start all over again. And that's exactly what I had to do. And as the years have gone by, the ability to invest myself in others, to genuinely give for the pure joy of giving, both to things and to people here in the program, of the people that I, and by the way, now almost all my closest friends are all members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not all, I said almost all. But the degree of relationships that I have now with men and women is so much deeper than it ever was before. That the gift that I feel, I can have not a penny to my name, but I have so much to share of just good, just the goodness that I feel inside, that I can do something. I don't have to have anything. I can have a deplete bank account, but that doesn't mean I don't have something to give. And so the enormous reward of feeling this synergy with other people, and not feeling more than or less than, or even, you know, not ever even thinking in terms of comparison between one and the other, just feeling that we're all in together, is it brings a sense of peace to me that is hard to describe. Having said all that, doesn't mean that Duke is a serene, laid-back, happy-go-lucky dude all the time. I have lots of issues that cause me consternation and hand wringing, and I get pissed off sometimes, but it doesn't last long. I have a lot of doubts about which way to go, what to do sometimes, but it doesn't eat on me. I can quickly ask for help. I'm going to stop and ask for directions. And so no matter how rocky or how rough things get for me, I know that it's a temporary deal. And I've also been humbled to know that when things really get good, that's also temporary. Yeah, when I close the big deal McNeil, and I think I'm just so full of myself, I know that that may be the last one I'll ever do. So I don't take it too seriously. I guess I want to kind of wrap up by saying that this journey has been it's been a process that I never could have predicted. It's put me in a place that I never could have imagined. And as we've heard many say before, if I had written down a list of things that I expected out of my effort to stay sober and to be a part of this community, if I'd written all that down back then, I would have undersold myself. The opportunities that I have today to be among my fellows and be among my business colleagues, and I'm also involved in a lot of things with the active army around the state, so investing back in the soldier community is very important to me. All these opportunities have come by having my ass whipped and taking a beating. I mentioned to a friend here Saturday, I think, about sometimes I felt like that. Most of you are too young to realize or remember John Cameron Swayze on the early days of television with this commercial about just like a Timex, it can take a licking but keep on ticking. And so for me, I'm 16 years along and being dedicated to the principles of this program. I'm a lot more than dry. I'm still working on sobriety. I've got lots of little pockets of gaps and vacancies that need to be filled, but I keep on working at it and keep on trying and keep on learning. And I think, when the call comes for me to join the man upstairs, I'm just glad I'm going to go to it with a clear head and be as sober as I can be. Thank you all for having me tonight.
The right way, the wrong way, and the AA way. Thank you. Thank you very much. And Murray's going to hand out the chips.
My name is Murray, and I'm an addict and alcoholic. Here at the Naval Club, we have a chip system to mark your time in sobriety. If anybody wants to get in this boat, or anybody that fell out of the boat want to get back in, we offer a white chip.
What?
30 days silver. 6 months red. Or was it 90? 90 days, Harry. Thank you. 90 days. Yellow is for 6 months. Anybody? Green for 9 months. And blue for years or multiples. Man, no hugs tonight.
Come here. Give yourself a hand.
Darn good practice, son. Thank you, Mark. AA-related announcements. Who's got it?
Well, Tim, I'm out of college.
Hey, Tim.
If anybody came in late, I'll put a couple of baskets on the table back here. And remember, on NavaClub.org, we have, Tim has well over 100 speakers. To listen to them.
Hopefully. Good, good. Next week we have Gary N., Gary Neihart. And the week after that, Bill W. Yay! Actually, Bill Walker from the Back to Basics group. So it's going to be great. Anything else? Speak now. If you want to volunteer to help, you know, we appreciate it. If there are no further announcements, I'll remind you that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer.
Open up my eyes so blind.
don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt.